Welcome. My name is Gilad Bernstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build the world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
Freedom of conscience, one, should be upheld, but two, like freedom of conscience, it also directly relates back to AI in this whole world. Like, it's
absolutely
not like it's not separate from, and I think that was like certainly what we were trying to get at with that statement. It's like it actually has implications across labor, the rights of workers to be a person of faith. It has implications on even how we think about AI and how it's inserting itself into the family, which has religious practices. Like, there's sort of that Venn diagram.
Today, we have as our guest a member of the AI and Faith community who has been hard at work over the past few years trying to ensure that AI's arrival benefits all of us, including children and families. And I can't wait to learn from him. There's a lot to talk about, so please help me welcome Ben to the podcast. Let's get started. Thank you so much for joining us. To kick things off, please tell us a tiny bit about yourself and your background.
Gilad, thanks so much, and thank you, AI and Faith. Part of my background really is AI and Faith for the last 8 years. So I know some of the founders of AI and Faith, and we've gone way back. And it came from this intuition early on in the early responsible AI days, where I was like, so I'm a person of faith. I'm also, certainly a technologist and a practitioner in my own right. And in the earliest days of responsible AI, we had these principles. It was like bringing kind of my BA in philosophy into the picture, where it's like, okay, there's values and principles. These have something to bear on technology, and how do we turn those into practices? And that was the first wave of responsible AI. But as I progressed through my career in responsible AI, leading teams and handling regulations and building guardrails, and there's lots to say there. But what I did see was this kind of gap and missing piece of faith, of religion. And it's so fascinating in that, like, most people in the world are religious, right? I think I often use this statistic of like 3/4 or 85%, depending on what you're quoting. And yet it was just a kind of a complete miss on the inclusion space, as we talk about inclusion in responsible AI or fairness. And then there's implications on all of it, as we're finding out now across the ecosystem. And so it's just a moment of both gratitude for AI and Faith pioneering the space, for me being a part of it as an advisor over a long period of time, and then also doing experiments at Microsoft. So we actually had like an AI and Faith event at Microsoft where we brought churches together. I convened this whole kind of day-long event, and that was a foray into my work before I left Microsoft. It was where I co-founded this initiative called Technology for Religious Empowerment. And it really kind of the first of its kind in big tech, in that it's explicitly researching, studying, and with the intent of empowering religious organizations with, from a technologist perspective. And that's kind of rippled out, I think, into the world. And we can talk more about the ways that has been rippling out. But it's like the movement of AI and Faith, if you will, is just so much broader than, we could have imagined a few years ago. So it's amazing to be here and talking with you at this point for AI and Faith.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the work you did is so important, and your work you're still doing is so important in bringing more voices to the table. You know, one of the things that I always say is that if you believe, as I believe, that the average person out there is a decent person trying to live a good life and do good things out there, the more of us engage in this conversation, the better chance we have of bringing AI into the world in a way that's pro-human and pro-humanity. So we are grateful to having you today, and we're grateful for the work you do in our community. Now, before we dive into your current work, let's take a quick look back at the responsible AI movement. So give us a little backstory. Where did it come from? What were some of the pillars that were focused on at first? And where is it moving? Where is it going now?
Yeah. We mentioned, we talked about this a little bit, but really the earliest days, if you can think about, like, let's say 2016, 2017, which in tech years is many, many, many years ago, but certainly isn't that long ago, all things considered. It was really this kind of first tops down thing where a few of the leaders at Microsoft and other companies were saying, we should have a principled approach to AI. It's not that we know all the answers about how to do that, but we should form expert groups around some core principles and concepts. So there were things like privacy and security. There were things like I mentioned, inclusion and fairness, transparency, accountability, these big words, big concepts. And the whole kind of exercise is basically taking those concepts, defining them, turning them into practices, turning them into concrete technical solutions, and thereby creating a system that is, kind of quote unquote ethical or safe. And it's never a one and done deal. It's always a exploration, and kind of like there's this science element to it where there are good, better, best, and even bester approaches to some of the methodologies. Is this mix of imagine like my position back in 7 years ago or whatever it was, 8 years ago. It was kind of at this nexus of the legal group, the policy group, the product group, kind of everything in between, communications and so on, and just the, kind of playing that central role. Amazing and unique experience. And again, this comes back though to the fact that like faith and religion, it was there was no dialogue or even discussion about it happening. I was just happened to be a person of faith in that role, which was great. But as we became more bold, emboldened, I guess, by the movement, and I also, would just get inspirations. I think that we talk about this in my tradition as the instinctus spiritus sancti, the sense of the Holy Spirit speaking to us and inspiring even our thoughts and our actions. I do feel like there were points at which that became so clear to me of like, I have to do this thing, even if it gets me fired, or I have to do this thing because I can't rest right now. I have to like go act, and that's where that came from, with the AI and faith church collaboration. That's where the Technology for Religious Empowerment group came from, and kind of all my work since then. I feel, not that I know all the time that I'm doing God's will, but it's sort of this faith that I am at least in the ballpark.
Absolutely. And what you said there really resonates with me with the Jewish concept. I think it's from, okay, I'm not going to attribute it to any of the scholars because our Jewish friends will tell me that I attribute it to the wrong scholar.
Sure.
But it basically says that we as Jews don't have the obligation of finishing the work of perfecting the world, but neither are we free to desist from it. And I love what you said there about, I just had to do it because it was the right thing that I was being compelled to through my conscience, through my faith to do that. And I just find that to be such a powerful concept. And the hope is that we can inspire even more people to take their faith, their philosophy, their beliefs, and to act it out in the world. And I think that's really exciting. So, as a natural transition, tell us a little bit more about the Faith Family Technology Network.
So this network is about, let's call it a year old. And Faith Family Technology Network is an initiative much like the AI and Faith organization. I would say that what we've been doing is a bit more on the political side in terms of action. So we'll talk about that in a minute, I'm sure, about the various ways in which we've taken, run the gamut from, theory and philosophizing all the way through to political action. And there's lots of stuff in between. And our members are really experts in the world around AI and faith from their own traditions. And so, and again, many AI and faith members are part of FFTN. Many people in FFTN do things for AI and faith. So we're friends and partners here. And it was started from a conversation with Jaron Lanier and Michael Toscano out of the Institute for Family Studies, Glenn Weil, myself, Brad Littlejohn, and some others, really piggybacking off of this A Future for the Family work. So there's still a website called afuturefortheFamily.com, I believe. And that's a vision for what we're, just like we were missing the religion and AI connection. And we can talk more about that. I have so much to say. But when it comes to AI and the family, it's obvious that that was also a miss. So, in the last few years, many companies have child safety initiatives now. I started Microsoft's first Gen AI and child safety initiative cross company. And there's always been like an eye towards like, let's say, the worst of the worst of child safety issues happening. So we, without going into a ton of detail, like companies obviously do care about child pornography not happening on their platform. And, like there are very clear protections. There are still gaps. There's lots of issues in that space. There's companies like Thorn that are doing wonderful work to bridge that gap from a technical perspective to really move the needle. But then when I was leading this Gen AI and child safety movement, I was basically saying like, look, there's like the legal bar and there's like the worst of the worst. And then there's like this gray zone that, like,
Yeah.
of all the stuff that, like, we just don't have consensus or like clear indication on what we should be doing here. And just as an example, it's like, should a teen be able to use like image gen to create some sort of, racy-ish photo, or,
Yeah.
like there were just things like that were already popping up because, Gen AI plus like image generation and all these other things were happening on our platforms. And it was like, we need to have some indication from the outside of like what's the bar? So there's like the legal bar, but then there's like this kind of human bar, right? Of like what do we owe each other? What do we owe our
Yeah.
children? What do we owe the next generation? And then there's this, I would layer in what I'm now talking about with organizations is like, there's also not only is there the human bar, but there's like the intra-human, there's the divine, there's the earth human divine. Like there's lots of bars to meet, and
Yeah.
it's very, very high. It means that we have so much work to do. And so the Institute for Family Studies houses the Faith, Family, and Technology Network. The intention behind the work is to advance across the spectrum of religion and AI, religion, AI and the family, religion and AI, and dot dot dot. It's kind of like,
Yeah.
we do a lot more than just those two, and we'll talk about that. And the network is about, I'd say, like 140-ish people at this point. So it's still growing, still kind of earlier days. And we're actively working on that growth, but also like getting us together. So we'll be meeting at Notre Dame this summer for our first actual in-person event. And we have some work kind of leading up to that and some outputs that we're excited to release later this year. But for now, I would just say there's a few things on our site that are examples of the work that we've done. And we could certainly talk about that.
Yeah, well, that's a perfect transition. As I was preparing for our conversation today, I was able to read some of the things you published, and a lot of it incredibly resonated with me. And one of them was specifically a statement you put out on moral guardrails for artificial intelligence. And I grabbed just a couple sentences that really resonated with me from the opening of that document, where it said, "We, the undersigned members of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim communities, write to express our deep concern over the U.S. government's campaign to compel AI companies to remove fundamental ethical safeguards and to mete out unprecedented punishment on those who do not comply. We write together because what is at stake transcends any one of our faith. The sanctity of human life, the right to privacy and dignity, the freedom of conscience itself, these are values sacred to our traditions and enshrined in the founding documents of this nation." That incredibly resonated with me. So expand on that a little bit, and also help us connect the faith piece to the Constitution, some of our founding documents, because I find that really powerful to say that it's not just from our faith, it's actually from the founding of our country that we want to hold these things so dear and so important.
It's so true, and it's just often forgotten. I think I'll zoom out for a second, zoom back in. The human rights community, for example, there's kind of like there's a responsible AI community, and then there's like the human rights lawyers
Yeah.
and like practitioners. And like what you always miss in human rights assessments is like freedom of religion. So it's like,
Yeah.
and it's strange because it's Article 18 in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that this is our fundamental human right to freedom of belief or conscience. And our freedom to worship, and our, really the an ideal version is that one can choose if that's available, and one can express, one can live out. And you think of a back to our nation's founding, I think there's a some amazing kind of tidbits here where like James Madison in Memorial and Remonstrance of 1785 said that like conscience is unalienable, and emphasizes that like we cannot follow the dictates of other people. We have to, like, there's this internal conscience element as well, like for sure. But there's this other one too. I'll bring up Thomas Jefferson in the Virginia Statutes of Religious Freedom. He condemned the government's efforts to force conduct against belief as sinful and tyrannical. So it's like you have these founding fathers, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, I could name more. Within the kind of DNA of our country is this religious freedom as like a focal point, a central point of how we live out our lives. Not to mention, religious freedom being kind of the transition from the United Kingdom over to here. Like you got,
Yeah.
folks were doing that for a big reason, for the expression of their faith, free expression of their faith.
Absolutely.
And so like from that, I think, the idea that freedom of conscience, one, should be upheld, but two, like freedom of conscience it also directly relates back to AI in this whole world. Like it's not like
Absolutely.
it's not separate from, and I think that was like certainly what we were trying to get at with that statement. It's like it actually has implications across labor, the rights of workers to be a person of faith. It
Yep.
has implications on even how we think about AI and how it's inserting itself into the family, which has religious practices. Like there's sort of that Venn diagram of like AI and distortion of said faith bridges upon the freedom to encounter the truth and know the truth. And surveillance is this other big area that we talk about in multiple statements and kind of amicus brief that we put together, is that the right of the individual versus the right of the state and the like privacy kind of being a bit of a wall in the sense of like there are things that I don't want to be known.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily want the government in my house of worship while I pray to God, right? So
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is a really nice transition because I wanted to bring up the amicus brief that you wrote. And maybe before we get into the details, just remind us, why was this necessary? What's the case going on? Just give us the quick background.
yes, yeah, so maybe something fundamental to say here is just that like AI's capabilities are compounding and are on an exponential growth curve. Let's just call it that. Like I'm more convinced than ever that that's the case. I'm not like an AGI accelerationist. I'm also not like a total doomer.
Totally.
I wouldn't even say I'm in between. I'm really trying to discern at any given day and moment where we are and what's happening and things like Mythos. I mean, it's just very real. I was at Anthropic. I know kind of under the hood what's going on in some sense with these technologies. And while there's amazing capabilities and there's stuff that we haven't even thought of yet in terms of what these systems are going to be able to pull off, it's true that they can also be used as weapons, and they can be used as implements of terror, and they can be used to oppress in ways that I hope we don't find out, and in ways
Yeah.
that I hope we can protect against. And so that's the backdrop of this work with so we filed an amicus brief with the help of Rakesh Kilaru and a wonderful team over at the Wilkinson Stelkoff was our pro bono lawyers, and they just did a fantastic job working with us. And the idea is that we wanted to help at this moment and provide a support from a multi-faith perspective in the case of Anthropic versus the Department of War, because the Department of War was really saying like, hey, like in terms of red lines, the Department of War sort of decides what it can do with the technologies. And Anthropic's not saying like we will never allow our technology to be used in any autonomous weapon now or in the future. Their position was essentially like our technology is super powerful, used incorrectly in ways we don't understand yet. It could infringe upon the rights we just talked about, the right to life, the fundamental human dignity, and that's some of what we go into. And like, let's continue the dialogues. That's kind of like the us versus them picture of
Yeah.
it. But where it's gone is it's gone to the courts. So I mean, it's past the point of like talking, and now in the courtroom. So the point is, what we wanted to do was bring it's it. There's some legal aspect, legal argument aspect, but really it's just to provide the moral fabric
Yeah.
upon which let's hope a judge or a jury could look at. I mean, that's part of the case, right? I think that's the point of amicus briefs. And it's to say, here are the reasons for our different faiths, why we, one, shouldn't just blanket statement approve autonomous weapons willy-nilly. And then two, mass surveillance infringes upon everything we just talked about. So that's the background of
Yeah.
that brief. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought it was incredibly powerful the way that you took principles from your faith and, from our various traditions, and you packaged them together in a way that was both relevant for the modern time as well as relevant for the law and the specific question, right? So you already touched about a few of them. We talked about freedom of conscience to not do things you believe or are taught from your religion are immoral. You talk about the fact that killing is a grave moral act that must never be fully delegated to machines. There has to be some human with the ability for them to have consequences, for them to exercise their own morality over that. As you just referenced, mass surveillance violates the dignity of God granted to every one of us, and individually. And then you said something that I loved, which is legal doesn't mean ethical. That's obviously true. And the idea that, I mean, and this it's true in this case, it's true in other cases, where people want to be able to do all legal purposes, especially in situations where they get to define largely on their own what they think is legal, certainly feels like a slippery slope that we would like to avoid. There's a lot of really cool things in there. A couple of things I'm hoping you can elaborate on a little bit is you spoke about the right to refuse. Tell us a little bit more about what that means.
Yeah, so like I think that one's an important one where the First Amendment, right? I mean, it's just about having that protection to exercise your fundamental rights and freedom of speech. It's been misused in many cases. So for there's a whole Section 230 and like social media world, and like the way that we structured our approach to this was like very careful, where we just said, oh, and I'll also mention there's the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is one more bit here that applies. Number one, the freedom to believe, the freedom to say, the freedom to do isn't just an individual thing. It's like, there's also this kind of this collective approach, this organizational approach. And yes, like legal precedent does build up towards how that can be exercised. Again, the Section 230, like we think that some interpretations of how that gets done is not what we're arguing for. We certainly want that to be changed, but I think there's the side of like the organization itself taking a stand shouldn't be punitively acted against, right? So it's like, in other words, an organization like Anthropic or others that decide that they don't want to sell their systems, however powerful they may get, to do X, Y, or Z, like is within the right of a corporation to exercise. And like to remove that as a real possibility for corporations will, one, disincentivize general ethical behavior, and two, I think it could have like restrictive effects on both like the competition landscape and like what gets offered in the future. And so I just think of it like, let's talk about it from like a pro market perspective, like pro freedom of a company to kind of do what it would like with its ethical stances is what we're also defending against. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea that these
24.
are all impactful on other realms of life. And if the government gets to force a company to do something, who knows what other organizations could be forced to do things outside of their morals or outside of their views in the future, which is why I see this as our audience knows I'm an investor, I'm in the business world. So I care about this deeply as a business person, but I care about it even more deeply as a human who wants to live a free life in this world. There's one other thing that you said in there that I really liked, went back to the surveillance piece where you wrote, in fact, authentic religious exercise depends on freedom from pervasive government monitoring. And I just felt like that's, I've never heard anyone express that, but it seems completely right to me that like it's very hard to truly practice your religion if you're being listened to or watched or whatever all the time. And of course, in many of our faiths, we believe we can have a direct relationship with God. We're certainly not interested in the government getting a relationship between us and God. So that really resonated with us. Now, before we run out of time, I wanted to bring up another writing that you published recently that I thought was really cool. And it was a memo on religious liberty for the Religious Liberty Commission. And within there, you had six like intersections requiring urgent attention, I think is what you called them. And I found most of them really do require urgent attention. So I'm going to call out a few of them. I'm hoping you just share a few thoughts on that, kind of what the problem is and just early thoughts. And we're all thinking about this together. But the first one is AI companions and the family. Why is that something we need to pay attention to?
Yeah, I mean, from sycophancy to suicide, like AI's interaction with children is just so concerning on many levels. And while there's a few companies, I would say my friend Tim Estes, Angel Q, and some others, they're trying to build AI systems that are designed for children, and that's great. I think it's a worthy exercise. Personally, I wouldn't let my children use AI at the moment, and they range from 12 to younger, and it's like, they have used it before, and it's already became problematic. So I have an anecdote of one, but I would also say that there's just I think we have the example of, I mean, so many suicides, so many like attachment issues and relationships being formed with systems that simulate personhood. We can get into the personhood of AI systems later or some other podcast, but I think that it's very easy to fall into the trap of things that like most of our traditions would just basically call sinful or problematic, right? Like it's just going to get in the way of their growth as persons and their relationship with others and with God. And it gets back to our point about what we talk about with there's like the legal stuff, and then there's the gray zone. With the gray zone so inarticulately formed across the whole area, although I think I've liked what Common Sense Media and some others have done recently on like criteria for AI systems. And generally, if you look at their gradings, you're basically like unacceptable, 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 high risk. You know, it's like they're in line with what I'm saying. We just absolutely have to get those things right, down the line and come together to define what we want. And then I think there's also like some basic things that are being done, like age verification, that are just super critical. Where I think there was a case in Louisiana where age verification was put in for underage children accessing Pornhub, and the traffic declined from something like 80% to 20%, right, for that age group. And it's like, and I might be getting those slightly wrong, but just throwing out that out there is like, I don't want kids doing that. I want families to be able to have choice. Like, age verification is a net good, and it's not perfect, but it's a good thing to put in.
And I tell all my founders, perfect's never on offer, only better is on offer. And that's, we got to take the better route. And I love what you said, that really resonates with me. And I also believe strongly from a regulatory framework that AI demasking should be the standard. You should have the right to know if you're talking to a human or if you're talking to an AI. I think that's a really important element there.
Yeah,
Okay,
Washington
I know.
State just passed a law like that. I think that's an interesting one to check out. Just that, like, I see like state regulations pushing forward in a nice way on the child safety front, in a way that is encouraging to everybody.
Encouraging everybody, and hopefully something we can all agree on, at least around protecting children. The next area I'm hoping you could speak to briefly is bias, distortion, and the representation of faith within AI.
Bias and distortion, just like classically, are problems of AI systems being probabilistic, right? I think it's like you over-index on some training material for one interpretation of the Talmud or one another interpretation of the New Testament, and you're just going to get some interesting outputs. I think there's work being done across the board on benchmarking, which like I'm encouraged about, and we're having some role in guiding and helping kind of connect some of the dots, which is like, you have Petra AI Studio, which is like Buddhist AI evaluation platform. You have Islamic MMLU, which is a benchmark for evaluating systems on Islamic knowledge. Gospel Coalition doing AI benchmarking. I think of it like there are just so many that are like in their own tradition rising up, and then there's like connective tissue of maybe there should be like a benchmark of benchmarks, or like some benchmark coalition to talk about the benchmark coalitions of various groups. And I think that's one way to go about it. I also think methodologies like post-training alignment according to one's tradition, and that's promising as a path forward. But I think it all comes down to like either misrepresentation or false information or missing some of the facts too. I think in my own tradition, it's very tiny, but it's Eastern Catholic, and so I have there are some like historical factual information bits that systems just don't have because the texts of record are like not super widely published. And our community is what, 100,000 or something in the west side of the states here. And so like the point is like we're actually building a little system to prove this out, to say like how are historical questions different from, and the answer is different from the main systems, and hoping to correct that either by giving access to data or all that business. So I think that that's just one example of want to make sure that my story is known and my tradition's known and in a way that's correct.
Before we run out of time, I do want to ask you about one more of these: autonomous systems and the sanctity of human life. That obviously seems like something we want to pay attention to, but tell us more about that.
Every tradition holds human life as sacred. In my own tradition, there's a wonderful founding, there's a document called Infinitas Dignitas, which is this treatise on our infinite dignity as human beings. And I love that framing. And it's also certainly sets an impossibly high bar for any system to autonomously infringe upon that, our inherent worth there. So you can think of like a autonomous weapons, certainly on a degree or a spectrum. It's not like it's A or B, because autonomy, we know this from our other sciences, is that autonomy is also on a spectrum. And so one could think of, like a drone with a gun, could be fully autonomous. It could have insertion points, where somebody decides yay or nay. But I think what we're really arguing for is this reality that our embodiment, our ability for remorse, our ability to check things like the feeling in our gut or the pinch in our throat before something happens, before we take action, is critical. So I think of it like this is an area where there should be really deliberate work instead of fighting. But right now we're in the fighting phase of like, the courts doing things. I think of it like Anthropic's expressed interest in doing the deep research required to understand those degrees of autonomy and understand kind of the spectrum of possibilities and what really is moral and permissible in war, and also just informed by our deep wisdom from the various traditions on the topic.
Absolutely. And I want to finish this segment by just quoting another beautiful phrase that you published in one of your recent writings. It says, "Our tradition commands us to enjoin what is right and to forbid what is wrong. When a company takes a principled stand at great cost to itself, our faith do not allow us to stand by in silence." And I just think that is the most powerful thing that people of faith around the world can take, and to use our faith and our tradition to bring good in the world, which I think is the whole point of these traditions in the first place. So I thought that was a really beautiful way to encapsulate all of that. Now,
Thank you,
before
but
I
I'll
can.
just jump in for one second and just thank you for saying that, Gilad, and also acknowledging that those pieces wouldn't have come together with a really intentional and beautiful working across traditions kind of approach, like where we it's not to be interfaith with like watering things down, it's to be multi-faith and interreligious in our collaborations, and also do it with like the expertise that can speak back into those systems. And I think that's the kind of the secret sauce of what we're doing, and where I absolutely couldn't have written these pieces by myself. I think there were because it was I represent one tradition deeply, and I've traversed through a few others like Buddhism. That's for another time. We could have a part two sometime, but the story is really that it's a one of deep collaboration across traditions that I'm most proud of.
Absolutely, absolutely. And of course, that resonates so deeply with all of us in AI and faith. Now, before I let you go, I do want to spend a few minutes talking about your own usage of artificial intelligence within your own personal faith practice and a few of the lessons we may be able to take. So, first question, have you used artificial intelligence in your own religious observance and how?
So, yes, I have asked questions of multiple AI systems regarding my faith, sometimes to red team them and sometimes to get some more insights. I'll say that sometimes before I begin doing so, I'll say a prayer, I'll cross myself, and that was a recommendation of one of my spiritual fathers, and I find that to be a good one, where it's like just a moment of reflection, pause, or even perhaps blessing on our use of it. It shouldn't be downplayed. So that's one practice before we even talk about the specifics. But another is like I think I use it to really get to widen my aperture about and like there's this quote I often say in conversation where it's like whoever sees more is more right. It's an old German phrase and from one of my favorite theologians, Hans Urs von Balthasar. The reason I love it so much is that sometimes the one who can be right or the thing that can be right is the system, and not myself. So I've created this kind of persona within Claude around a thinker that I hold dear. It's some of his concepts. So it's Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, and he's a French Jesuit priest from the early 20th century. He was one of the discoverers of the Peking man. So it's like this kind of early hominoid discoveries that changed our minds on, wait, we have an evolutionary history in it. So there's a science side of him. And then there's this like mystic side of him where it's like there's this thing called the noosphere that like we're all kind of working towards and this collective intelligence that's part of the fabric of our reality. And there's a way to do it that like is fully expressive of our own individual, like our own originality and our also our interconnectedness and does not destroy our diversity and our unity. These are things that like if I were to tell you like my own personal creed of like stuff I'm doing with all of my work, whether that's speaking on podcasts or talking to interfaith groups at companies or conferences or what have you, movement making and inspiring, it comes some from this one thinker, which is it's been amazing to really unpack his work. And so I have this persona called like the noosphere. So like I talk to the noosphere quite often in order to get ready for things or think about things differently. And even like I was speaking to a bunch of employees at a tech company recently, and I wanted to get a take about like, okay, so everybody's freaked out about their jobs and like the job apocalypse and all that business. I have some really great things to say about that another time. Molly Kinder's The Messy Middle is something I absolutely recommend everybody read right now. But the thing is, I was like, I don't want to think about like the immediate problems with you, Noosphere. Like, I want to have hope from the future. I want to have hope from like, not from like a dystopian accelerationist view, but like a deeply mystical religious perspective about,
Yeah.
that in 100 years, who are the AI saints of the future, the kind
Yeah.
of perspective. And working through that helped me kind of suss out some of the deeper points I wanted to make in response to like my own internal struggle and my own journey and my own messy middle of my career. It's like, yeah, after leaving Microsoft, it's not the same, but it's wonderful and terrifying and a good time right now. I needed support in that journey of myself and also to support others. And so that's just one concrete example.
Yeah, and that was a perfect transition. As we think about supporting others, where do you see opportunities for members of your faith to deploy AI within either their personal faith practice or in their efforts to live the values of the faith?
Yeah, I think there's so many good things like Magisterium AI and this own thing I'm building, Byzantine.ai, and they're systems to help our own formation and catechesis, but like not replace the like formal versions of that. And I think they're helpful for things like it's really hard to parse like the code of canon law in the Catholic Church about what to do about X, Y, or Z. Like my sister's cousin is marrying, a person of a different faith, and like, is it okay for them to, blah blah blah? Like,
Yep.
it's like it'll just spit out the canons and give you a nice answer, and it's like better. It's just way better than like ask, most things. Except that I still would, want somebody to go to a canon lawyer for certain things, and I think that's the kind of attenuation that we're seeing of like, let's call them the white collar administrative jobs of religious organizations. I think that whole thing is going to get changed and disrupted. That's a matter of redeploying, rescaling, rehoming some of that those
Absolutely.
folks to like more quasi-pastoral roles or something. Like that's where my brain goes. But I think of it like, by no means am I advocating for like an AI deacon as one of my bishops humorously recommended. But yeah, it's
Yeah.
like yeah, the clergy shortage won't be solved by robots yet or ever. But I think of it like, there's also just a time to explore, people who are adults certainly like recommend other creative ways. Like I think that's a moment to be innovative and to be forward thinking and not afraid, but also like to guard our children, protect our families,
Yeah.
with its use, to keep that which is sacred. An AI mass or an AI divine liturgy for my tradition is just, it's still not the same. It won't be valid. It's just
Yeah.
not, because there's something about the physical, sacramental, mystical that is what imparts grace, in a
Yeah.
special way in my tradition. And I think everybody has versions of that in their own faith. And keeping that sacred, I think, is so critical.
Yeah, absolutely. And then finally, what are some lessons that the AI community and the world could learn from your faith about the responsible stewardship of AI?
I think we're at a moment where I can probably step aside for a few weeks and the Pope is going to say what needs to be said,
Yeah.
in my tradition. So I'm excited for the encyclical to come out, in that regard. But I think we're all still working on this really diligently. Responsible stewardship, I think of it like the nice word thing about the word stewardship is that it's inclusive of everybody. Like I think the regular mom and pop store owners could use AI to write their senator about the thing that they want. Like I think that the super highly educated lawyer can go advocate for the right policies. The teenager can courageously work together with their family to be different than their peers about things like AI and bullying and so on. I
Yeah.
think there's but stewardship, I think, also is this clarion call to the research community, to the experts of the world, to those in AI and faith. To those in FFT and networks like it, like just to really double down on the hard problems, the research, the science, the alignment of, individuals, institutions, societal structures, economic, democratic, and so on, and the models themselves. Like what truly is the best alignment our wisdom traditions, our faiths, our religions can offer. And I can't think of any more critical work than that at the moment. The stuff about mythos escaping, its containment, and
Yep.
the worries I have around capability acceleration and recursive self-improvement, those are not made up worries of AGI religionists anymore. Those are real phenomena happening. So, be aware that that's happening.
Yeah.
Now is the time to align. Now is the time to collaborate. Now is the time to make a difference, and not a few years from now.
Yeah. And like I said at the beginning, we are just so grateful for you joining us, and we're so grateful for the work you're doing in our world to bring AI in a way that is pro-human, pro-humanity, and supports all of us individually. So thank you for being with us. And of course, thank you to all of you in the AI and faith community for joining us for another conversation. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much, Gilad, and I am Faith. Be well.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.